It's my great pleasure to be here and to visit PI again. So thank you for inviting me here. Roger invited me, and today I'm going to talk about something related to holography and deep learning. It's based on a recent work with Xiaoliang Qi and his student, Zhao Yang. So my collaborators, Xiaoliang at Stanford and his student, so we use TensorFlow to implement our algorithm, and these are our findings to acknowledge. So the outline, today I will basically talk about two networks. One is the tensor network and the other is neural network. And tensor network has been known to have a lot of applications in holographic duality, or ADS-CFT. It's a way to understand holographic duality in the discrete basis. And neural network also has a lot of application in deep learning. And recently, there are many works indicating that maybe these two networks, given their structural similarities, maybe there are some connections between tensor network and neural network. So that connection may inspire us to think if there is any connection between holography and deep learning. And that's actually the main topic today. So today I will introduce an algorithm we try to propose, which is called entanglement feature learning. The goal is to learn the entanglement features or entanglement structures in a quantum many-body state. And through that learning process, a neural network structure will be developed in the machine. And if you open up the machine and look at what's the neural network structure, and that structure in terms of geometry, it should correspond to the, it could correspond to the holographic spatial geometry. So it's an idea that this geometry, holographic geometry, emerges from machine learning. And the material to learn is the quantum entanglement. So we will demonstrate this algorithm in a 1D free fermion CFT. Okay, so let's maybe start from a review of a tensor network. So tensor network is an efficient way to represent a many-body wave function. Let's say we have a Hilbert space of qubits, and these are the basis states which are labeled by the qubit state. So any quantum state, quantum many-body state in this qubit Hilbert space, multi-qubit Hilbert space, can be represented as a superposition of all these basis states, and the superposition coefficient is the many-body wave function. And this wave function is a function that maps the states of the qubit, zero or ones, a string of zero or ones to a complex number. So this many-body wave function can be also think as a tensor, because if you consider a complex tensor, once you fix all these tensor indexes, zero or one, then this tensor elements is also a complex number, which is this wave function. So we can think of a quantum many-body wave function as a big tensor, a huge tensor. It has many elements, it has many entries, 2 to the power n. N is the number of qubits or the number of legs of the tensors here. So these are a lot of data. And can we have a more efficient way to represent or to store this data? So tensor networks, instead of a single tensor, is a more structural and efficient way to represent this quantum many-body wave function. So one simplest example maybe is this EPR state. This is a 2-qubit state which whose wave function is like this. And if you write it as a single tensor, of course, it's possible. But you can also split this single tensor into two tensors, smaller tensors, and connect it by a link. And this link connecting two tensors means you contract the indices of the tensors. And then it turns out these tensors, smaller tensors, are identity matrix, such that you can actually draw a line joining these 2-qubit degree of freedom. That this line represents the EPR pair state. And on the other hand, EPR state is also a simplest example of quantum entanglement. So it's a 2-qubit entangled state. And this quantum entanglement is characterized by the entanglement entropy. It's one way to characterize the entanglement, which is a quantity which tells you how much the subsystem is entangled with the rest of the system. Let's say if we want to study the entanglement between S1 qubit and S2 qubit, what can be done is we first construct a reduced density matrix by tracing our S2 degree of freedom from the density matrix of the full wave function, and then raise the reduced density matrix to the power n, and then take the trace and log and do this 1 over 1 minus n. And this gives a formula for the so-called Renyi entanglement entropy. And for the EPR pair, this Renyi entanglement entropy is a 1-bit, actually. So I just try to give a definition because I will use these quantities later. So this is Renyi entanglement entropy. And then in quantum information, people also define mutual information, which is an entanglement entropy between of these two subsystems added together minus the entanglement entropy of the join of the two systems. So for these EPR pairs, it's 2-bit. Anyway, so in the following talk, when I refer to entanglement entropy, I will focus on the case where this Renyi index is 2, second Renyi entropy or the mutual information. The point here is try to show that each line in the tensor network like this can be think of as an EPR state. Each line, it's not just contracting indices. Another way to think of it is you use an EPR state, entangled pair state. And then also this mutual information characterizes how thick the line is. It's an effective bound dimension of this line. So EPR states are two-body entanglement. And can we go to further, more complicated entanglement, like multi-body entanglement? So the idea is that EPR pairs, they are actually building blocks of complicated many-body entanglement. One way to think of that or to realize that is you consider, for example, in this example, we prepare three EPR states, which are these lines, and then distribute it between Alice and Bob, Alice and Charlie, and Alice and David, let's say. And then Alice has three qubits, and she did a measurement. This measurement will project this three qubits to a three-qubit pure state in the measurement basis. So this is like doing a measurement, doing a projection of these three qubits. So once the measurement is done, now the B, C, D qubits, which are not measured, not touched by the measurement, they will be entangled. So the way to generate entanglement is to first distribute the EPR pair and then make measurements here and there. And this will give you a very complicated entanglement structure that can go beyond two-body entanglement. And this is an underlying idea that people formulate or define tensor network state using this entangled project pair state idea proposed by Westros and collaborators in 2009. So in this language, this is the equivalent language of defining a tensor network state. It's, a tensor network state is defined by given a graph which contains the vertex set and the edge set. And on each vertex, we define a pure state, which is the tensor on the vertex. And on each edge, we define an entangled pair state. And yeah.
I just wanted to ask a quick question. So just confused about the indices, because as I understand, each edge, each vertex at the edge corresponds to one index, and you can contract only one pair of index. So it seems that, like you are contracting three indices in a circle, in the red circle.
These three indices are projected to a pure state. So on each line, you still contract one index. So A, the pure state A is like a three-leg tensor. And then each EPR pair is just a line. Then you stick the leg to the match the leg. So that's the idea. So that's an equivalent way to formulate tensor network. But I think it will be more useful, you will see later. Because then we have more degree of more freedom to adjust the amount of entanglement across the edge. Originally, if we just purely contract the leg, it's just a fully entangled pair EPR state across the edge. And now we can use any entangled pair state, not necessarily maximally entangled. And the amount of entanglement across the edge is characterized by mutual information of the edge, which we denoted I of E, mutual information of the edge. And then a tensor network state is basically a partial inner product of this entangled pair state characterized by their mutual information projected to this pure state on the vertices. And the remaining unprojected, this remaining unprojected degree of freedom, there will be a quantum state supported in this degree of freedom, which is a tensor network state we define. So this is a way of defining tensor network and why it is interesting. So first of all, tensor network, of course, it's an underlying basis for many useful numerical algorithms in condensed matter physics, including DMRG and MARA and PEPS, including many experts working in this algorithm here. So the point I want to make here is another point of view is tensor network is also a very useful geometric way to view the entanglement structure of a complicated quantum many body state. So each line in the tensor network, you can consider it mediates some amount of entanglement. So each link carries some amount of entanglement. And this amount of entanglement in a tensor network is bounded by the bound dimension across this line. And so if you have a very complicated network like this, if you want to know what's the entanglement in this region A, you can simply count the number of links across the cut if you want to separate region A from the rest of the region. In the tensor network, there's a minimum cut. And the number of bounds cutted by the minimum cut times the bound dimension, suppose all the bound dimensions are the same, then you simply times the bound dimension. It doesn't give you the entropy, but it gives you an upper bound of your entanglement entropy. So this formula is similar to something in ADS-CFT, in the holographic duality. Which is known as the Rita-Kanaki formula, which tells you the entanglement is the minimum area in the bulk holographic geometry. So if you consider a tensor network in this shape and the minimum area separating A from the rest of the region is this minimum surface, and then the entropy will be proportional to that. So Schwingel proposed tensor network holography idea. It's a microscopic way to understand this formula is by tilting this tensor network in this curved space in the bulk holographic geometry. And then the tensor network state will produce the entanglement property, which is similar to this formula. But if we really want to treat this proposal seriously, we actually need to deal with this less than equal sign. It's an upper bound, but not equal sign. So if we want to make it equal, what's the condition? So what kind of tensor network can actually saturate the Rita-Kanaki bound? And there's some early breakthrough from these people. And this is a very nice paper. They propose that if each tensor in the tensor network is a perfect tensor, then this bound can be saturated. And it's related to holographic quantum error correction codes. But later on, they show that this can be, because this perfect tensor network is somehow still fine-tuning, if you can use random tensors as each tensors, and this random tensor network actually automatically satisfy the so-called perfect conditions in the large bound dimension limit, and such that in the large bound dimension limit, a random tensor network will saturate the Rita-Kanaki bound and can be used, yes?
Why do you want to saturate?
Because that matches the Rita-Kanaki formula.
It's not a formula for a tensor network, so why? I mean, you could say that the log n d is the one. I mean, this formula is not for a tensor network. What does it mean to match that formula with a tensor network?
At least to match this part, d, yes, d is just a constant. But you wish that the entanglement is proportional to the minimum area, not just bounded by the minimum
right.
area.
To be proportional is one thing, and to saturate the bound is another thing.
Is it maybe just, I understood it as if you saturate the bound, you kind of have the minimal network required to satisfy the entanglement criteria of that state.
Minimal network?
Like as in the lowest bound, the lowest bound dimension, right?
Right.
So in that sense, it's the minimal network that still has
to... No, but Ryota-Kajanagi, that doesn't tell you that you have to saturate the bond dimension. The bond dimension has to carry as much entanglement as possible. It's logically disconnected. I mean, you can have this area law, in the holographic geometry and yet not be that log MD gives you the maximum amount.
Oh, I see your point. So we don't want to saturate the bound dimension log of, we want to saturate a constant, which is only related to the mutual information across the bound, and not necessarily the bound dimension. So here it's not, the goal is not to saturate the bound dimension. The goal is once you if you change the minimum surface, the amount of change in the entanglement entropy must be proportional throughout the network, which is a constant throughout the network, but not necessarily maximally entangled.
Okay.
Yeah. So random tensor network, you can use that to realize this property. So let's give a mathematical definition of this random tensor network. It still follows the PEP's definition of the tensor network, which I just introduced previously. But now the difference is that on each side, originally we introduced a pure state, which is specified. But now this pure state on each side is a random state. And then we just distribute the entangled pair state, and this does not need to be maximally entangled. It can be entangled, and the amount of entanglement is characterized by the information across the edge. And then we project each site to a random pure state. Okay, so this is the picture. The after the projection, the remaining degree of freedom is the random tensor, will support the random tensor network state. It turns out that this random, the entanglement entropy, if you try to calculate the entanglement entropy on the random tensor network state, this problem can be mapped to our Ising model. So why it is Ising model? I'm not going to derive that because it's in this paper, but I just try to give you an intuitive understanding of why this entanglement property is related to Ising model. Because if we think of using the idea of holography, entanglement is some minimum cuts through the tensor network. We wish to establish that. Then basically, if we believe the claim that this entanglement will saturate some bound, and then this to calculate the entanglement in this problem, we just want to find the minimum cut through the network that separates the region, subregion from the rest of the region. So finding a minimum cut in a graph, this becomes a mathematical problem, how to find the minimum cut, the way to cut minimum number of bounds. In network science, people use some called minimize the network modularity. But for physics, that kind of algorithm is just minimizing the Ising domain wall energy. So what people do is we can introduce Ising spins on each vertex of the network. So this is a network, let's say it's a network structure of your tensor network, but you can also think of it just as abstractly, it's just a graph. And this graph has vertices. And each vertex originally is your tensor, but now I don't think of it as a tensor, I think of it as an Ising spin. And I should stress that this Ising spin has nothing to do with the underlying qubit degree of freedom in the network. It's just, the reason we talk about Ising spin is I want to calculate the second ring entropy. If I want to calculate higher ring entropy of a random tensor network, it turns out this Ising spin will be replaced by some higher order SN group elements. But we'll not talk about that. So consider each tensor is now replaced by an Ising spin. And then this is an Ising model. Each line connecting two vertices is a ferromagnetic coupling between the Ising spin, which I write it as this one, sum over all the edges in the edge set. For each edge, you take the boundary of the edge, which is the two vertices of the edge. And then this product is like sigma 1 times sigma 2, sigma I times sigma j across the edge. So there's a ferromagnetic coupling in the bulk. And on the boundary, there's some external legs. So for these external legs, there's some pinning fields. This pinning field is specified, the direction of pinning field is specified by another set of Ising variable tau. And this tau Ising variable is not dynamical, it's a boundary condition, it's fixed. And it's fixed to such a way that in region A, we fix it to upspin, polarizing, trying to pin the boundary spins to upspin, use an upspin pinning field. And in region A bar, we pin it to, let's say, downspin. So with this Ising model with a boundary pinning field, this boundary condition set by the entanglement region that we want to specify, In the large J limit, in the ferromagnetic phase, actually this pinning field will try to pin the spin in the same direction, and the spin will pin the box spin into the same direction as the boundary spin. So eventually they will compete along this domain wall. And then they will settle down in a configuration such that the domain wall automatically minimizes its number of cuts, its length. So this is a way that this statistical mechanic model automatically finds the minimum cut by minimizing the domain wall energy. And the length of the cut will be proportional to the energy cost of the domain wall, which is 2j times this minimum cut length. So if we compare to the entanglement entropy proposed by Reed and Taknyaki, then maybe this J is a bound dimension, if we can saturate the bound dimension. This is a formula for the random tensor network in the large bound dimension limit. So it seems that for the random tensor network, if this tensor has some bound dimension, and this bound dimension will tell you what's the Ising coupling in the Ising model. And the larger bound dimension means the tensors are more entangled, then this Ising coupling will be stronger, which means in the Ising model, it will be more ferromagnetic correlated. So this is a mapping that maps the entanglement property in the tensor network to the spin correlations in the Ising model. More entangled correspond to more correlated in the Ising model. And if we really go through the mathematical derivation of this, you really take this tensor, random tensor network state and try to calculate the second ring entropy. And these authors, they show the second ring entropy problem maps to the free energy of the Ising model, where the free energy is by tracing out all the bulk spins subjected to some boundary conditions specify the tau spins. And this tau spin is the boundary condition that is set by the entanglement region that we try to choose. Because when we try to calculate entanglement entropy, we need to specify this entanglement region. And in region A, all the spins is on the boundary is pointing up. Region A bar is pointing down, using this up and down pinning field to pin the boundary spin. And then the free energy of the system with this kind of a pinning field configuration compared to the free energy where all the pinning field is upward, and the free energy difference will give you the second ring entropy of the random tensor network in the large bound dimension limit. And in this formalism, this Ising coupling across each edge in the tensor network is actually proportional to the mutual information across the entangled pair state that we use to construct the random tensor network, divided by 4. So the Ising coupling is the same as the mutual information, and it does not need to be maximally entangled. So it can be. So the formalism gives us some freedom to adjust this mutual information as a real number. If you consider bound dimension of a tensor network, it can only change discretely. Bound dimension can be integers. So log of bound dimension can only take several discrete values. But now if you consider more generally, you connect the tensor network by a general entangled state. It can be any real number to adjust. And this will be the variational parameter in machine learning, which we try to find the optimum tensor network structure to describe the entanglement properties of a given quantum many body state. So for a single connected region, what are the possible entanglement properties we can have? Actually, that strongly relies on what kind of network geometry you have in the bulk. For example, if you have a matrix product state-like network, then you get the area law. And if it is a network in the hyperbolic space, then you get the logarithmic scaling of the entanglement entropy. But if you have a very dense region in the network here, then you get a volume law because all the geodesic, all the minimum areas, minimum surface try to avoid this region. So this region is like a black hole. There's a horizon. No geodesic can pass through. And in principle, all different kinds of graph geometries can be realized on a complete graph if you connect all the bounds. And by changing this connectivity, by adjusting how these bounds are connected, by adjusting these real parameters, there are a set of, although there are a lot of parameters to adjust, But anyway, you can try to think of it as a optimization problem. So the goal is to search for the optimum network that describes the entanglement structure. So the theme of this holographic duality is actually proposing a duality between entanglement structures and holographic geometry. And previous idea is it's this way around. Once you are given a holographic geometry, and then you tilt the tensor network on the geometry, according to the geometry, and the tensor network will produce the entanglement features. So this from the geometry to the entanglement. So in this talk, I try to solve an inverse problem. So if we have entanglement features, suppose we can measure that from a quantum many body state by doing a lot of experiment measuring different entanglement entropies over different regions. Can we determine the optimum holographic geometry out of that? And the parameter to adjust, of course, is the mutual information across the edge in the random tensor network. We use it as our model for tensor network holography, which also corresponds to the Ising coupling strengths in the Ising model, in the corresponding Ising model. So in this way, we don't want to worry about what's the contents of the tensor, because anyway, the tensor is random, but we only want to think of what's the optimum connectivity between these random tensors. So we focus on this connectivity, and it turns out this connectivity has the most to do with the entanglement structures. And if you treat this coupling strength across the each link as a quantum degree of freedom, then you can actually use that to construct a quantum basis in the bulk, which can be used to formulate quantum geometry. This in another paper of us. But I will not talk about that today. I will now, in this talk, we will treat these coupling strengths as classical degree of freedom, such that we always want to minimize or optimize these real numbers. It's a lot of large set of real coupling strengths. So we want to tune the couplings in an Ising model in search of optimal network connectivity. This sounds very similar to optimizing a neural network. So is it a machine learning problem, we may ask. And in a machine learning, actually, there are two big learning algorithms or schemes. One is a supervised learning and unsupervised learning. So maybe let me give because many people here also work on machine learning. So yeah.
Can I ask you just to clarify the goal here? So you have a wave function. You compute all this entanglement. So this is between different parts, between different qubits, or what?
Between different qubits.
Just qubits. So you have bipartite two-qubit entanglement throughout.
It's a wave function supported on a bunch of qubits, yes. And then you specify what's your region A. It's a subset of the qubits. It does not need to be connected. It can be disconnected.
Right. So and it's between the subsets of qubits and the rest.
Yeah.
Okay.
But is it physical qubits?
It's only the physical. You only measure the entanglement between physical.
So you have this, for each bipartition that you can think of, you have this amount of entanglement?
Yeah, suppose.
And now the goal is to tune these couplings?
Yes.
But in the end, this will produce what?
This will produce a network of Ising model. All the couplings are determined. And this Ising model, using the relation of entanglement, is a free energy difference of the Ising model. It will give prediction of the entanglement entropy over all different regions in this random tensor network models.
But
and we want that entanglement to match the entanglement you measure from a black box.
But the final object will not be a representation of the original wave function.
Yeah, it will not be a representation of the... It will be far from a representation, because it only capture the entanglement properties, but it doesn't capture the other structure, like the tensor contents.
So it's just a bipartite entanglement structure for any possible bipartition?
Yes.
And you already have this information, right?
You
already measured all this information from the beginning.
We measure this information, but we don't know what's the geometry that will produce this information. So using this algorithm is trying to find the geometry, the network. Like, we don't know whether this entanglement structure is produced by an MPS state or a Mara state. So we want the machine to determine whether I need to use an MPS to describe it or narrow, or which one is better.
I ask just two questions. So first, did I understand correctly that so physical spins are basically spins on the boundary of the network, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And the bulk of the network are just auxiliary spins.
Yes, yes, yes. You never touch this auxiliary spin in the bulk. No measurement can actually probe this auxiliary spin. You don't know them. Actually, you don't even know how many auxiliary spins are there. You only make measurement on the boundary. All the measurement comes from the boundary. You only take separate all different kinds of disconnected or connected region on the boundary and measure the entanglement.
Actually, and then, ask one more question.
Yeah.
So you said that you're considering some random tensor network,
yes,
some
yes.
special kind of network.
Yes.
And I'm wondering to which physical states does it correspond?
It doesn't correspond to a particular state. It corresponds to an ensemble of states. Because each tensor, there's a random choice. So it's actually represents an ensemble of states. It's not a single state. Different states in this ensemble can be even orthogonal to each other. But the common property of this ensemble is they have the similar entanglement property.
Each tensor network is a wave function, right?
Yes, yes, yes. So here, it's not a wave function. A random tensor network state is not a state. It's not a wave function. It's an ensemble of a lot of wave functions, infinite number of wave functions. So it's a collection of these wave functions. And all these wave functions share the similar entanglement structures. That's the only, the goal of this is not to describe the quantum many-body state as precise as possible, because that's a very difficult task. For example, if you have a volume law state, it's almost impossible to do that, to actually find a tensor network representation that precisely describes a volume law state. But you can still find what's the optimum geometry that possibly describes this.
That would mean that there is maybe not really a tensor network, but also an ensemble of tensor networks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is like a two-step approach to describe a state. First, you find what's the tensor network structure that best describes this state. Once you fix the structure, and then you can do optimization on top of this structure to fix what's the tensor content in the tensor network.
Yes, but you are not guaranteed to be able to represent that particular wave function.
Yeah. I'm not guaranteed, but through this process, it's not guaranteed. The second step of optimization is much harder, and it's.
But it may fail.
Yeah, it may even fail. So
it's not a technical. It's not that you couldn't find the optimal within that tensor network.
Yeah.
Maybe that tensor network is not capable of reproducing the wave function.
It's also possible. It's higher obstructions. Yeah, that's So the goal. So that's why the goal is not to represent the. Maybe you will be disappointed, but it's not to represent the.
So you managed to attach a geometry given a wave function. The meaning of that geometry is a geometry that reproduces
entanglement. Yeah. So I try to produce. I try to propose this conjecture. It's not rigorous. I try to say quantum information encoded in a quantum many-body state can be separated into these two parts. One is the entanglement features. And the other part is the rest of the information beyond.
Even for entanglement features, you just look at bipartite entanglement.
You
can see all possible bipartitions of your physical qubits.
But although it's bipartition, but it actually contains three-body mutual information and all those. All kinds of entanglement property you can think of, all orders of mutual information between any parts of the any different parties of the separation can be constructed from the data of this entanglement entropy over all different regions, because we don't require the region to be connected. It can be separated. So for example, you have three separate regions. You can use that to construct a three-body mutual information.
Well, you can use it to construct any measure of entanglement that is
yes.
built from bipartite measures.
Oh, yeah.
By definition.
Yeah. You cannot go beyond that. But it already captures, I think it captures this. So if you consider, try to describe a quantum state, you can also think of it, I describe the reduced density matrix in each, you tell me a region, and I tell you what's the reduced density matrix in that region. If I can do that, I also describe this state. But if you, but this approach is like, I only tell you what's the entanglement spectrum of the reduced density matrix. Suppose you know the entanglement entropy of all orders of Renyi entanglement entropy. So I don't know what's the reduced eigenstate of the reduced density matrix. So all the quantum information encoded in the eigenstate are thrown away. And I only want to find the optimal network that fits the eigenvalues. So that's my goal. And I can only do that for now. So even that is a difficult problem because that requires you to fit all order of Renyi entropies. But here it's even weaker. It's only second Renyi entropy. So there are different ways to try to find this optimal network by machine learning. There's supervised learning, which learn from labeled training data, which you have input and label coming pairs. And the goal of this supervised learning is to establish a map from the input to the label by minimizing a loss function, by comparing your prediction to what's to the ground truth. And then there's also unsupervised learning, which learn from unlabeled data, which is some configuration that appears with a probability distribution, the empirical probability distribution in your data set. And then we want to train a generative model that generates this data set with a model probability. And we want these two probability measures to be as similar to each other as possible by minimizing the cross entropy between these two probability distributions. So this is an unsupervised learning scheme. It turns out both schemes can be used for this purpose, but in the following talk, I will focus on the supervised learning scheme.
So did you say that you are trying to optimize the couplings in the bulk of the Isaac model, I mean, in the bulk of the network?
The bulk is...
So did I understand correctly that, say, you have, Isaac model, which you view as a boundary, and are you trying to optimize couplings in the bulk?
And in the bulk, there are also auxiliary spins, hidden spins. Which
so my question is, are you trying to optimize the couplings in the bulk?
Yes. Yes.
And so one more question I just got lost. So what is, what are you trying to optimize? I mean, what are you trying to find? What are you trying to optimize? What are you trying to achieve by optimizing the couplings?
I will tell you what's the variational parameter and what's the objective function, then that will be good.
Yes, so what are you trying to find by optimizing the parameters?
The goal is to achieve an optimum parameter that parameter will parameterize the bulk geometry, the connectivity of the network, or the adjacency matrix of your graph.
I mean, in which sense optimal?
It's optimal by minimizing the objective function, and the objective function try to compare the entropy you predict with the entropy you measure. You have a quantum many-body state. Suppose you have some way to measure the entanglement entropy over all different regions. And you have a random tensor network, which is a theoretical model which predicts the entropy over those regions. And the prediction must match the measurement and by adjusting the parameters in your model.
So you basically, your goal is to find the random tensor network which has as much similar entanglement entropy as, say,
yes. 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 That's basically, but maybe let's still go through these slides. It's an introduction of Deep Boltzmann machine, which is, this slide is just trying to tell you why this problem is very natural, because Boltzmann machine, which is a model using machine learning, is also an Ising model. It's basically just a multi-layer Ising model. And each neuron in this Boltzmann machine is called it's actually an Ising spin, and the neurons on the boundary is called the visible unit, and the neuron in the bulk is the hidden unit that correspond to the boundary tensor and the bulk tensor in the random tensor network. And then this is also a generative model such that there's an Ising model defined in a graph. This is a graph proposed by Hinton, but we will not use this graph structure. We will use some other graph structure. But anyway, there's a graph in the bulk, and then there's an Ising model defined on the graph, and you trace out the bulk spin to produce a probability to marginalize the probability distribution to the boundary, and this boundary distribution, you try to match it to some data distribution. And this data distribution will be determined by the entanglement properties you measure from a quantum many body state. So in general, the objective function is a function of the free energy of this IC model with a given boundary condition, tau, which pins the boundary spin. And given the, it also depends on the Ising coupling J in the bulk. So we try to apply this deep learning technique to optimize the random tensor network connections. First of all, what's the training set? What's the big data? The training sets are the quantum entanglement. Suppose we can measure that from a quantum many. I know it's very difficult, but you will see some examples of free fermion system which that can be done. And also possibly experiments nowadays can measure secondary entropies in some systems in the co-Etting experiment. And so the suppose that can be done, then that's a big data which we use to define the so-called entanglement feature. This concept is defined in this way. It's a set of entanglement entropies over all kinds of regions in a given quantum many body system. So if you have n qubits, there are 2 to the n number of ways to choose this entanglement region. For each choice of the entanglement region, there's an entanglement second ring entropy associated to that. So there are 2 to the n number of real data that can be generated by measurement. Of course, you cannot exhaust them, but you can measure part of it, for example. So this is the data. And we don't have this complete data set. We maybe only have part of them. Can we make predictions out of this part of this big data? And then try to compress this big data to network parameters, which is much less than the amount of data we have. It's only the network connectivity is only parameterized by these Ising couplings, which is not grow as a exponential of the number of spins. It just grow as polynomial of number of spins. So then it's a compression. So you can also think of this learning as a compression problem or an encoding problem. You encode the entanglement features in the network structures of this Ising model. So the big data is inflowing from the holographic boundary. And then this data will, under the training, it will wash out or it will give rise to a geometry developed in the holographic bulk. That's a big idea. So the sample we take is basically all different partitions of the quantum many body systems. So suppose the system is a 1D system, then we take different partitions. Different partitions of region A, just labeled by different boundaries, pinning field configuration. And this pinning field configuration is equivalent to a set of visible spin configuration specified by this tau spin. So this tau spin is +1 in region A and -1 in region A bar. Once again, I want to stress, this has nothing to do with the quantum degree of freedom, the qubit degree of freedom. These spins are just labeling region A or A bar. This, on the boundary, this quantum degree of freedom can be much larger than a 2-state qubit. It can be a D-state qubit. You can still apply this. And then you still have region A and A bar labeled by +1 and -1, this boundary pinning field. So given this spin configuration, we want to So this is how do we generate the data. So given a quantum many body state to learn, each partition is associated to an entanglement entropy. So given a partition of the this qubit degree of freedom, we can calculate the second ring entropy. We want to fit this entanglement feature by a random tensor network, which is modeled by a random tensor network. You also give a prediction of this second ring entropy using the free energy difference, those formulas. But that's subject to the parameters you try to optimize, which is the Ising couplings in the network. So you tune these parameters, J, such that this prediction matches the data. This is coming from measurement as much as possible. And so the data is, this is a supervised learning scheme. The data is coming in pairs. We have samples, which is entanglement region. And then there's associated entanglement entropy. And then there's a prediction of the entropy from the free energy difference using the Ising model. And this free energy difference, of course, is tuned by the Ising couplings. So the objective function is try to minimize the difference between the prediction and the measurement. And then this is just a least square optimization. And the optimizer is some optimizer we use TensorFlow to construct. And then we also impose some regularizations, which we require each bound to be positive. Because this J is related to this mutual information, it's just a mutual information divided by 4 in the random tensor network, so it's a positive number. Somehow we also impose, in order to prevent overfitting, I will talk about that later, we also think that the if your tensor network has a layer structure, we wish that the IR layer has a greater strength than the UV layer. It's the idea that the entanglement must be resolved layer by layer. I talk about the opposite. It's a UV layer. In the UV layer, you try to resolve as much entanglement as possible and then pass the residual unresolved entanglement to deeper layer. So that's why we have these structures. And the whole algorithm is implemented in TensorFlow. And I will show you the result, numerical result later. But this is a slide that concludes the conceptual dictionaries between neural networks, machine learning, and this tensor network. So this neural network here is a random tensor network. There's a correspondence. And the visible layer corresponds to the boundary tensor. Hidden layer is the bulk tensor. And the edge weight is the mutual information of the entangled pairs that we use to construct this random tensor network. And the training sample are the entanglement regions, different training sample, different configurations on the boundary. It corresponds to different choice of the entanglement region. And the samples are labeled by their entanglement entropy. And the bulk geometry, holographic geometry, will be the neural network geometry after the training. So it's an idea that the geometry emerges from learning. And we have some very serious obstacles. If you try to optimize search in the graph space, in the complete graph, do arbitrary search of this graph structure, there are too many parameters to optimize. So, and also there are some gauge fixing issue. There's some gauge structure. It's possible that two different graphs looks different will give you the similar or even the same entanglement structures using this Ising model language. So currently we cannot solve this problem. So the way out is to do some gauge fixing. That means we need to specify some architecture of our learning network. And by specifying the architecture, like we consider the underlying graph is a cylindrical network, which means we place the tensor in this way. But there are still parameters to optimize, which is how strong these links are coupled. So suppose also we consider there's some translation symmetry in our system. So each layer shares the same weight, but different layer have different weight or this Ising coupling, or you can consider it's a mutual information on the bound in this tensor network. And if you only have J1 non-zero and all the deeper layer is turned off, then this is basically a matrix product state. However, if you have all the deeper layer, the coupling is turned on, this state, this network can actually give you a volume law entanglement. So it can represent area law state, volume law state, and if you have a hyperbolic structure, you can also represent this CFT state, possibly. And the boundary pinning field strength is set by the boundary physical bound dimension. So we say we have some free fermion chain. This is the quantum many-body state we try to learn. We want to learn the entanglement features in the ground state of a one-dimensional free fermion chain. The free fermion system is described by this Hamiltonian. It's a ground state of this Marana chain Hamiltonian, which we have a chain of Marana fermions coupling together by this coupling. This coupling is staggered, means it's a strong weak, like that. So you can switch the stagger pattern, then this gives you a mass. If they are coupling with the same, if the coupling is uniform, has a translation symmetry along the chain, then it's a CFT state. We have gapless Marana modes along this one-dimensional chain in the ground state. And then if you turn on the stagger mass, this stagger mass will give you a correlation length of the Marana fermion. It will control a length scale. And we can also make copies of this Marana chain such that we can realize the CFT, this free fermion CFT, with central charge n equals n over 2, which actually, this central charge counts the number of fermion flavors. So in this free fermion model, on the ground state, it's easy to calculate the entanglement entropy over all different regions using these Green's functions, the free fermions. So we can, in that way, we can generate this measurement data, the entanglement entropy, second ring entropy over all different kinds of regions as we want. So we try to train a hyperbolic tensor network to fit this entanglement data. And by training, so we have, after the training, you can see this is the result. It depends on what's your central charge of the system. If the central charge is large, then basically you will have some, the first, this is the first layer, icing coupling will be strong, and then the remaining layer will grow out of zero and then saturate to some saturated value, such that the machine thinks that this kind of network will best describe the CFT state entanglement properties. So here we set the fermion mass to zero, so it's the CFT state input. And it turns out that the training result...
Oh, sorry, if you put a mass, does it prune?
Yeah, there will be a cutoff. I will show that later. Yeah. So this this icing coupling will vary with the central. So this coupling JZ, Z is a layer index. So this is J1, J2, J3, J4, J5. And our model has a 32 unit cell. So at most, we have 5 layers because each layer will halve the number of tensors or spins. And then this JZ varies with the central charge. You can see the results is different with different central charge. And the interesting thing is that if central charge is too small, like one half, which is a one Marana chain, or one, which is a two Marana chain, we don't get any training in the bulk. And this is a problem. And also, this is a reasonable feature. Because we are trying to use the, when we use the random tensor network to model entanglement structure, we are working in the large bound dimension limit. So it means we are working in the limit where our unit cells or the UV degree of freedom has a lot of entanglement. But if your central charge is very small, which means the entanglement is not that strong, and entanglement is not that strong, and correspondingly, as you decrease the central charge, the icing coupling will become weaker and weaker. And it will become weaker to a point that the bulk can go through a ferromagnetic to paramagnetic transition. If the icing coupling is too small in the bulk state is paramagnetic, that's too far away from our assumption of the large bound dimension limit or the strong ferromagnetic limit. In that case, we cannot use, we cannot think of this minimum surface as an icing domain wall, because in the paramagnetic state, there's no well-defined icing domain wall. Domain wall fluctuates a lot. So in that case, it's like you have a fluctuating geometry. So a small c corresponds to a strong coupling or fluctuating geometry. So you may think this small c, you have entered a quantum geometry region such that you don't have an efficient way to learn that using this classical network. And these are some other tests. After the learning, you can try to ask the network to give predictions of entanglement features, entanglement entropies over a region, over a continuous region A. And for the CFT state, we expect a logarithmic behavior. This is the red line. And this black dot is the prediction of the network. And then you can see if you train it on the hyperbolic network, it gives a better prediction. If it's trained on the cylindrical network, it's much worse. It shows that the network, even though we cannot optimize between different underlying network structure, between different architectures, but there's still, you can see there's still a difference, which means if somehow in the future we can do this, also do this network graph geometry search, then there will be a training, learning gradient that try to optimize the network to a hyperbolic.
Cylindrical net looks, that's how it would look if it was a gap, right? If you had a path.
Yeah. The cylindrical network, it cannot quite represent a logarithmic behavior. So it use some area law state to fit that. That's why you have a flat top. And also, you can do some interesting benchmark. So you train this deep network, you can choose your training data, only use those continuous region entanglement entropy, and then train the network, and then ask the network to predict multi-region entanglement. So these all these different colors are multi-region. So the blue dots are from the single region entanglement. Red, green, is a two region, three region, four region entanglement entropy. And the horizontal axis is the actual entanglement, which we can calculate for the free fermion state. And the vertical axis is a prediction. If the prediction matches the measurement, it should fall all four in the straight line. So this is the result after the training. It's 95% of accuracy. And we can see this lower region. If your region is two regions, three regions, you still have some prediction power. But it's not very surprising because anyway, the entropy is dominated by additive contribution. So maybe the machine just remember what's the entropy in different regions and sum them together. So how about the prediction of this mutual information, which is a sub-additive part? And the machine also can give some prediction if you consider the region are close to each other. So suppose this is region A, region B. We want to ask what's the mutual information between them. This quantity will have a geometric interpretation because mutual information between these two regions is the entropy of region A plus entropy of region B minus the entropy of region AB. But in the holographic bulk, there's a geometric interpretation, which is the geodesic of this line and the length of this line minus the length of the line AB. So it's like asking how the sum of the two sides of a triangle in the bulk is greater than the third side, and the amount of difference between the two sides over the third side is a mutual information. So it's basically this mutual information is asking a geometric problem, is to the network, to the machine, and the machine can answer this problem rather nicely. So that means that the machine indeed build up some geometric intuitions about what's the possible bulk geometry. And then such that it can answer the problem like how the two sides, sum of the two sides of the triangle is greater than the third side in the bulk. But if the two regions are far separated, then their mutual information will go beyond this geometric interpretation. There's no simple geometric interpretation. There are also bulk fluctuating fields that will contribute to the mutual information such that the machine cannot give nice predictions for this case. So the machine only learns the classical geometry, or in another word, we are using a classical model to fit the entanglement properties such that the machine cannot learn the mutual information that is beyond this classical description. And finally, this is almost the last slide. It's we turn on the mass of the free fermion system such that there's a cutoff length scale, cut off by the correlation length set by the mass. So at the cutoff length scale, the tensor network will terminate at this scale. So in the learning, we will see the weight will decay. So for example, the mass is 0.5. You can see the weight will decay. And one, it will decay here. And then the decay position will be pushed towards the UV. This is the UV. This is IR, pushed towards the UV. And if you make a plot of this J, the strength of J, the strength of this coupling, in the large mass limit, if the mass is very large, we can see only the first layer is trained, and the deeper layer, they are not trained, which means the machine tried to use an MPS state to fit this basically an area loss state with a large mass. And then if the mass goes smaller and smaller, we can see the machine will be trained deeper and deeper, and then there will be a grow here. And then you can draw this boundary. This dashed line is a prediction by taking the log 2 of m, which is here. And we can see it matches this boundary very nicely. So it's the idea that as you push towards the CFT limit by reducing the mass of the fermion, you also get a ADS spatial geometry out of the learning. The network will become deeper and deeper. And that also matches the prediction of ADS CFT. So in the future, I think this is just the beginning of this learning, and maybe we can use this machine learning approach to understand MBL-ETH transition, because that's also a transition in the bulk geometry. from a no black hole state to a black hole state? And then can we see this black hole emerging from in the bulk? And try to understand better the structure of many-body entanglement and their dynamics. So with this, thanks for your attention.
I was wondering about the C equals a half case for the critical system where the J dropped off to zero pretty much after the first layer. Is that dependent on the system size?
I don't think so. It's because already at the second, the J2 is already doesn't get any training signal,
yeah.
Which means it's J2 is quite a UV. It's a second layer, right?
Yeah, but how big is the boundary system for?
The boundary system currently is a 32 unicell. And J2 is the second, just the second layer, which means you already, this UV layer, you cannot train it better. So even if you enlarge the system size, it's not going to affect this UV layer training. Maybe the IR depends on the system size, but the UV layer is just some local training.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering if the next layer is already UV, right?
So when the C is small, which means the entanglement is small, in the IC model, that corresponds to the spin-spin correlation is too weak. So such that there's no enough training gradient, there's no motivation to turn on Ising coupling in the bulk. Because the bulk, if the coupling is so small, anyway, it's in a paramagnetic phase. So there's no point to turn it on. So the machine will lose the gradient to turn on J2. Then if you cannot train the second layer, there's no hope to train all the deeper layers.
So you did this in two ways, fixing the geometry to be either cylindrical or hyperbolic.
Yeah, yeah.
But at some point I lost track for some of the results, which one was used. So the ones that show how the J changes are a lot.
Oh, it's in the hyperbolic.
So that's in the hyperbolic case.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
If you take the cylindrical case,
yeah,
and you look at the end result, does it
it's worse. Because hyperbolic, this is a comparison. Using enforce your machine to be trained on a hyperbolic net if you are a better fit of the entanglement.
Yeah, so if you look at the cylindrical one, just like draw a graph that shows the weights of the different lines, does it start to develop some hyperbolic looking features or like does it point to
unfortunately, for so if you release the requirement that it must have a translation symmetry in each layer, then yes, presumably it can automatically turn off some bump. And then a hyperbolic net can be embedded in this cylindrical geometry. But currently, we haven't done that.
I see.
Yeah. Because that's there may be too many parameters to train. It's a very small size. But
you're saying you didn't try it? Or have you
tried? I didn't try. I don't say it's impossible.
Yeah.
Because these are all done in my personal computer.
Uh-huh.
And each learning just take like half minutes,
okay,
to train a network, so
okay.
It's a very simple CPU training and yeah, small scale.
So in the classical deep neural networks, you need to propagate the signal in a supervised setting, right?
Yes.
But then you say that the J's in the subsequent layers sometimes are like zero or something. So I don't understand how the signal is propagated to the geolabel. I don't understand what's the structure of a neural network for the training.
Oh, the neural network is not like a feed-forward neural network.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So you do not pass information from UV to IR. It's you consider there's an Ising model, which is a generative model that generates some the thing that generates the free energy of the Ising model, basically. The output is the free energy of the whole Ising model. So you need to, so the objective function eventually is a functional of the free energy. And then any gradient of the objective function must become the gradient of the free energy, and then eventually that spread to every bound in the Ising model. And then the deeper bound, if it doesn't get training signal, you will not be able to train it.
Any more questions? You sound easier for another couple of days.
Yeah.
Make sure you can.